I think we have our guest on the line, Mark Jerome Walters. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
That was a little scary there for a minute. We have Sally sort of sweating on the other side of the glass. In this book, Six Modern Plagues and How We're Causing Them, you've charted the discovery and the spread of the six most virulent and dangerous new diseases, mad cow and salmonella DT-104, which is a new resistant to antibiotics, West Nile, Lyme, HIV/AIDS, and SARS. And you've connected them with industrialized agriculture, climate change, forest degradation, bush meat trade, globalization and technology. So what is the good news?
Well, the good news is that we've finally gotten a very hard teacher that's going to teach us about what we can and we cannot do, you know, with Mother Nature. And it's a hard lesson, but it seems to me that with the surge of new epidemics since in the last 30 years, of which there have been at least 30 identified by World Health Organization, that is forcing us to look at the way we do business in the world, the way we treat forests, the way we treat air, the climate, the way we treat animals and agriculture. And the lesson keeps coming back the same, and that is that we are doing things that are bringing these upon ourselves. So the good news is that we are not, after all, just helpless victims of nature. You know, we are victims of our own ingenuity at times. Where we are causing the problem, we can also try to solve the problem. And so I think that there is good news in this very, you know, dark story, in the sense of new epidemics.
So I think what you're saying here, if I understand it correctly, is that these new diseases, which are particularly virulent and seems to be moving us sort of backwards in time in terms of human health sociologically all over the world, is kind of behavior modification for the people who are making the rules?
I think that's a good way to put it. And it's not only behavior modification for those who are making the rules, for example, corporations that are so eager to use antibiotics in livestock to help the animals grow faster. But it is also, in a sense, helping to awaken each of us as individuals. You know, we go about our business in the world, and half the time, unconsciously, we simply forget that our health depends upon animals beyond us, things we can't see in the air, and species that really help to keep us healthy people. And so this is really a call to all of us, you know, when we get up in the morning, to remember once again that we are part of a larger community of life. And the more respect we show that larger community of life, in the end, the more, you know, benefits for our own health, you know, we are going to be able to gain.
So the common mistake, if we look at it, say, from the level of an individual in their own home, might be to believe that if you cover your body in some kind of spray pesticides before you go out in nature, or if you spray, for instance, for ants in your home, instead of looking at what it is on your property that's attracting, say, mosquitoes, or looking at why the ants are proliferating in your area, what their predators are doing, and what else is going on, that is that sort of the common mistake?
Yes, that we are forgetting the larger picture. We are accustomed to using the word sustainability in just about every field except for our health. We don't realize that in securing health in the way that we have, that we are in many ways penalizing future generations. We are healthy at an expense to our children and grandchildren. And, you know, we need to begin to look at health as a sustainable issue. For example, you know, the overuse of antibiotics now, both among directly in people and in livestock, is helping to suppress epidemics in livestock. And yes, it is curing the mildest of earaches in people. But the
actually, it doesn't cure earaches in people.
Well, it certainly, you know, combats the bacteria that will cause earaches. You know.
Well, actually, the latest research shows that it doesn't do that, that it's not good for earaches. I'm sorry, I'm getting off track, but go ahead with your point.
Yeah, the point is that as we use these to cure bacterial infections, even infections that shouldn't be treated because they are not severe, you know, that means that the bugs that are causing those problems are going to grow resistant to that. They're going to grow more virulent, meaner. And who's going to inherit that generation of these microbes? Well, it's going to be our children and grandchildren.
healthy animals, birds, and humans are usually less susceptible to getting ill. So, as you're pointing out here, sometimes interventions to prevent illness actually cause diseases, like you're talking about, I think, primarily the use of prophylactic antibiotics. You're talking about situations where somebody goes in and says, I have a sore throat, I don't have a fever, but give me an antibiotic anyway, or more than that, because I think the research that I've read shows that the individual's use of antibiotics is not causing the resistance, it's the use in the animals. But in addition to that, we've got pesticides, and then we've got vaccinations and other heroic measures that are designed for protection. So give us some examples of better models for protecting individuals and animals from opportunistic infections.
Sure. Let's look at some issues in agriculture. You know, one reason that we have been able to produce meat so cheaply for those of people who eat it is because we have cut every corner conceivable in the production of livestock. We have even gone to the extent of using the parts of cows to feed to other cows in order to save a little energy there, to save a little money. It used to be that when you butchered a cow and there were certain organs that weren't used, well, they were thrown out. Now they're rendered, so the term goes, into little pellets that can be fed back to cows. Now, we have essentially perverted the natural food chain. We have turned cows, which are very placid herbivores, we have forced them into a lifestyle of cannibalism. Now, that is the reason that mad cow disease spreads so rapidly. But that's just one example.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that example is that most of the as you point out in your book, most of the farmers who weren't huge farmers, where it started, where you look in England where it actually started to happen, these were moderate-sized farms, not huge industrial farms. And they weren't actually the worst in terms of crowding and treating the animals poorly so that they were ill also, so that they were susceptible, in other words. So they started in farms where it wasn't really terrible, but the farmers themselves didn't even know that the feed contained rendered animals.
That's right.
So it was kept a secret. It wasn't even freely acknowledged.
Well, it's certainly true that these smaller farms tended to feed their cows, traditionally at least, hay, you know, with cows and grass, what cows were meant to eat. But another example is salmonella. Now, salmonella frequently causes food poisoning, and it's had a long history of that. But it seems like every time certain antibiotics are used in livestock, that is to make the animals grow faster, that then you get a new type of salmonella in people, which is resistant to those drugs. And so here's a problem that we are causing, and we are not far off, at least in theory, from a solution. We simply have to be much more judicious in how we use antibiotics, and that would mean to most people simply banning the use of antibiotics to help animals grow faster. Who benefits from that? Well, largely it's the corporations who own these farms, and yes, there's a trickle-down benefit for people of a few cents per pound. But who pays the cost of that? We all do, and not only our generation, but the next generation as well. But there are two examples of where we can simply do business in a better way, and it's these epidemics that are really helping us to begin to realize this. And that's why I do not see these as all bad news. We are really entering an age, paradoxically, of certain enlightenment along with the emergence of these new epidemics.
Well, going back to what you were saying, there are two issues here that seem terribly important. One is that, as you mentioned, when animals are raised ethically, in other words, when they're allowed to graze or eat foods that are natural to them and are kept in with enough space so that they're not infecting each other with diseases, and they're able to move around, so they're in good health, and they're, you know, ethically treated animals actually don't need antibiotics usually. It's very rare that an animal will need them if it's raised healthily. And this is true of human beings, too. If you raise an individual in a healthy environment and you don't expose them to overcrowding and they're not on the plane all the time, they're less likely to be exposed to a microbe or an organism from somewhere very far away, which is what's happening right now. So raising them in a healthy way, it decreases probably the density of the product to market. And that means that the price of the animal protein goes up. But what we find is it maybe goes up $1 a pound. It's not very expensive in terms of, but the price in the long term is a much greater price because we see people actually dying of these, as you say, resistant microbes that are becoming opportunistic in these environments where they're being these antibiotics are being thrown at them. So essentially what we're saying is that the use of something prophylactically seems to bite us in the butt afterwards. That's what seems to be happening here. But, you know, there's more to this story, because what we're actually seeing is that the world is shrinking. And we're not only seeing something happening in England where farming practices, which are very similar to the farming practices that we use here in the United States, are sort of back, there's a backblow and it's exploding in the faces of these people and it's causing disease. But we're now seeing that silly things like the importation and destruction of endangered species in other countries and bringing them over to this country on planes, and the fact that the United States is industrializing parts of Africa and growing cotton, of all things, to import back to us, making the people in the areas where this is happening terribly impoverished and no longer able to use their land, are resorting to eating actually bush meat or animals that may be contaminated with microbes that their bodies can handle but our bodies can't. So what we're seeing is that what happens here is affected by what happens in Africa and other countries. So it speaks to this issue of nobody is really safe if people on the other side of the world are in poverty.
That's certainly true, and it also speaks to kind of the truth that there is nobody in this world to whom we are not connected. So on the positive side, it reminds us that, you know, the human family, this is no longer just the metaphor it once was. We truly are, and we are connected to each other. And one of the reminders that we frequently have about this is, as you point out, the microbes that can move from one side of the world to the other within a matter of hours.
I just want to remind people that you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness, and we are in a fund drive, and you're welcome to join us at any time during this show and get various thank you gifts. I am here on the KPFA side at 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732, and I have various thank you gifts to give to people who joined. But more than anything else, what I'd really like is for people to support the station during this hour. And all this sort of frou-frou about, well, we have Mark Jerome Walter's book, Six Modern Plagues, to offer you as a thank you gift. We also have other gifts, but the real gift that you're getting is Free Speech Radio. And as you know, we're in the middle of a fund drive where we're really struggling this time, and never has there been a time where we needed your help more. So please go ahead and join us at any time during this hour, although I will give you some time to pledge. It's interesting that the FDA has resisted banning the use of antibiotics in animals for a very, very long time. So I'm wondering how it is that those of us who are listening and those of us who are reading your book, how you want us to put pressure or enable things to move along. I mean, I think people feel slightly helpless because there are policies at this large level like the FDA, and it makes us feel a bit powerless. How would you speak to that?
I think there are two answers to that. One is in what we teach, you know, the people we know and our children. You know, when we hear about a new disease, and we will hear about another, you know, sooner or later, is not simply to recoil and teach, oh, we must get a cure for this, but to step back for just one moment and try to understand the larger picture of what it's a part of. This is an immensely teachable moment, you know, when this occurs. And that is a sort of teaching that can move into the future and really slowly help to change the way people believe.
Do we have time to wait for children to change? Don't we have to do something now?
Well, I think that brings me to the second, you know, uh-huh, answer to your question, and that is, what can we do now about it? We can make certain choices in the sort of meat that we buy. We don't have to buy the meat that's raised with antibiotics. So there are certain decisions, buying decisions, purchasing decisions that we can make. And it's also, I think people underestimate that the power that a few voices in a community can have when it comes, for example, to a bill coming before Congress on tighter regulation of the use of antibiotics among livestock. Is communities count. Congress, you know, representatives listen. And we are seeing some tremendous headway being made on the issue of antibiotic use in animals because corporations like McDonald's have made decisions not to buy beef, you know, that is raised with antibiotics. Why are they making that decision? Because they have seen their consumers express concern about it. And so I think it's important that people realize that a few voices in a community, when they're brought together and a movement builds, can have an impact.
Yeah, so and you vote with your dollar is what you do.
You vote with your dollar, you vote with your voice, and you vote with your children for the future.
Let's talk about some things that are a little closer to home. For instance, you discuss Lyme disease, which is very prevalent on the East Coast and is becoming more prevalent on the West Coast in areas where people like to go out in nature and hike around. What's interesting about the story of Lyme disease, as one topic in the book, is that it is a call to encourage biodiversity and lots of different types of animals in a forest, not to destroy the forest's natural balance of predator to prey. So why don't you talk a bit about what the example of the Lyme disease epidemic is in terms of what lessons we need to learn in how we steward our forests, even those of us who are living near them.
Lyme disease, the story of Lyme disease, is a scientifically based parable. And what it says is that in the healthy forests of old, which had a great complement of different species of birds and mammals, and therefore fewer deer because there were more predators, and fewer mice because there were other animals that competed, you know, for food with mice, that Lyme disease was not an epidemic. As forests began to be cut into ever smaller pieces, they began to be cut more frequently so that they were younger trees. The so-called generalists took over, and that was deer and mice, who can live just about anywhere and will take advantage of any kind of vacuum when other species move out. They happen to be the two species that transmit the tick that carries Lyme disease. And so we see degraded forests and an explosion of deer and mice. We also see that coupled with people moving out, you know, wanting to live near forests and their yards next to the woods. All these have kind of converged to create a major epidemic. I mean, a disease that is now the most common disease spread by a tick or mosquito, in this case by a tick, in the United States. And this is a disease unheard of only a few decades ago.
So what sorts of precautions, you know, the normal precautions for Lyme disease is people are warned to dress a certain way and check themselves after and yada, yada, yada. But the real protection would be for people who are trying to live in a forested area, is it not a call to, and I'm one of them, I live in a forested area, to, as I said, literally learn about the culture of the forest that you're living near and to make sure that you're stewarding diversity in your own forest. So you're not using herbicides and pesticides, so that you are encouraging the development of biodiversity, both in plants and also in the animal species. So, for instance, I understand that there's a certain lizard which has been sort of hunted out of existence by domestic animals that also is a predator for the Lyme tick, and there are also predators to deer that have become have moved out of areas because of our moving into them. So yes. What kind of advice do you have for people on that end?
Well, it raises very difficult questions, but you're absolutely right. Learn about the cycle of which people are part in Lyme disease. And simply by learning that, the cycle of the tick in people and deer, we gain a whole new understanding of you know, our place in that neighborhood and ways that we might be able to prevent Lyme disease. Simply working at the edge of where our yard meets a forest is one of the high-risk zones that's been identified by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Yes, we can always take precautions of, you know, covering ourselves with long pants, you know, when we go out, you know, be careful where you hike. We can also hope that we develop a vaccine for it, but, you know, that is a short-term proposition, much needed, but short-term. What a lot of people don't realize is that when ticks carry Lyme disease, they also carry other diseases that are, you know, would not be prevented by the vaccine. So that is a short-term, you know, measure, and we need to begin to see it, as you say, in terms of the diversity of the forest, where we choose to live.
So what would you recommend to people? How would you recommend that people begin to interplay with the environment in a different way, practically speaking?
Well, you begin to, as you say, use what you need to do in a practical sense to prevent it. It would also be to possibly encourage, you know, a greater diversity of animals, although that is difficult to do, you know, on a matter of a few acres. More effective would be to, you know, join efforts in your community to protect larger tracts of land to minimize the fragmentation of forest.
Yeah, that would be, that would be a start.
This would likely, you know, the sort of thing that would, in over the long term, have a, you know, a greater impact on
it. I might also add that the replacement of native plants to an area, if you're going to garden at all, that you not remove natives and that you add the natives back in so that there is food and plant life that attracts the sort of natural animal life that lives there, that you pay attention to how you clear undergrowth in the forest, because some of it may be a natural. You point out this in your book when you discuss the natural kind of environment in a forest, what it's like and how you can protect that. Some of that information's in your book. We're going to need to take a brief, you know, minute or so break. And so I just want to remind people that you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. Those of you who are listening in Mendocino, I'm sure that you will be getting some numbers to call to join the station during this hour. On our end, what I'm looking for is, you know, obviously this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm on the phone with Mark Jerome Walters, author of Six Modern Plagues, and we're talking about how people can interact with the environment and the rest of the world to protect ourselves from these sorts of plagues and what kind of behavior would be useful. So I'm going to play a little bit of music, and I'm going to encourage you to call during this short break, 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. I have the book Six Modern Plagues and How We're Causing Them by Mark Jerome Walters for $125 subscription, which is a thank you gift, as I mentioned. I also have the 2-CD set of Michael Moore speaking in Sonoma, which I went to and was amazing, really encouraging, really made me happy, that for $75. And I have a CD of the California Nurses Association Conference featuring Jim Hightower, Ralph Nader, Dennis Kucinich, Barbara Enright, for $60. You can also just get, you know, KPFA t-shirt for $60. You can also mix these up. So give us a call right now during this break and join us at any level that you can give, any amount, even $25, and don't have to get a thank you gift. 510-848-5732, 1-800-439-5732. We'll be right back. I just want to, I'm noticing here that absolutely nobody, oh good, I'm seeing a couple of phone lines light up. This is a really good time to join the station. Please remember, you know, we do the best we can during the fund drive to try to bring a show to you that will make you want to buy the particular premium that we're offering, but that isn't what we're offering. What we're offering is this programming and this airway, which was so brutally taken away from us for about 2 months a couple of years ago. And will we ever forget what it was like to not have this radio station? Please get on the phone right now and call 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. Please join us now at whatever level that you have. Please join us during this fight to stay on the air. Remember, there is nothing that the right wing wants more than for you guys to get to a point where you're so angry and hurt and discouraged and helpless that you don't have any energy to fight. That's what the right wing wants. We have to stay on the air. We can't do it without your money. And I know that you guys are hurting for money and you're generous with your money. Please remember that any donation during this hour will help us. You don't have to get the book. Anything that you can give will help us. 510-848-5732 or out of the area 1-800-439-5732. Please pick up the phone. Join KPFA. We are having a very, very tough time raising enough money during this fund drive. I wouldn't be asking you if we didn't need it. Frankly, you need it too. You can pay on a monthly basis. Get Michael Moore's CD. It's a wonderful CD set for $75. Get Six Modern Plagues and How We're Causing Them. Find out how you can interact with the environment in a healthier way for $125. Get a KPFA t-shirt to wear proudly on the street. Join us at $25 so you can vote in our thing, you know, the elections that are coming up. But join us now, please. 1-800-439-5732. Join the few people who are calling right now. 510-848-5732, and I'll get back to my interview in just a moment. I'll give you some music to pledge by. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. Thank you to those of you who are calling. Please do continue to call during the rest of the show, and I will give you another chance to get on the line with us. But please remember to keep calling. I'm on the phone with Mark Jerome Walters. We are talking about six modern plagues and how we are causing them, although I doubt that my listeners are causing them. You know, it's interesting, your description of how HIV/AIDS came into being, you know, with this consumption of bushmeat and the infected simians, the infected primates in Africa, strikes me that that's only one theory of why HIV/AIDS exists. It certainly is the most environmental theory in terms of people in poverty who have not, I mean, gosh, people in the Congo, could you be any poorer than that? Could you be any more politically disrupted than that? So we have contributed to that problem, and in that sense, we are to blame, at least our administrations, going all the way back to Eisenhower. But what I'm wondering about is that I noticed that you didn't kind of go into that other theory, which is that it was kind of bioterrorism gone wrong.
And you're speaking of the HIV/AIDS?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Well, you're right. There have been numerous theories ever since, you know, this was first described, trying to account for its emergence. And in 1999, it was shown convincingly that the HIV virus that caused the pandemic came from a subspecies of chimpanzee. And that has been shown, you know, very convincingly. The question remains, how did it get from a chimpanzee to human beings? And it is true that the bushmeat theory is just that. It's a theory. Although there has been some very interesting convincing evidence on that. For example, not long ago, a scientist went around to some bushmeat markets in parts of Africa and tested them for the SIV, or the monkey equivalent of HIV, and found that one in five had an SIV in it. So that just suggests that, well, if these things are jumping from simians, there are monkeys, chimpanzees, that bushmeat markets provide a great opportunity. Now, let's not forget, though, that the reason the bushmeat trade has accelerated so much in the last 20 years is because of logging, in large part to feed European and Western markets.
Bingo.
And so we may well be connected to this. You find that, you know, when especially European countries such as the French moved into countries of West Central Africa, they employed tens of thousands of loggers, and they settled them in camps. Well, how are they going to feed these loggers in these remote camps? They were going to hunt more chimpanzees, gorillas, crocodiles, snakes, and every other imaginable animal to feed them. And so there has been this huge acceleration in commercialization as of the bushmeat trade, driven by Western demand for these woods from the forest, would have created an ideal opportunity. It would have upped the ante. It would have increased the probability many times over that these viruses would jump to human beings.
Yeah. You know, the other insect vector thing that's frightening is this West Nile stuff, because it's creeping over to the West Coast here, and recently in Sonoma County, where I live, they discovered that there was a certain type of plant that had filled in these boggy areas and was a very, very good nesting place for this the type of mosquito that carries the West Nile. So they're in the process of trying to eradicate that plant, but they're also using instead of using pesticides, they're using a more kind of slightly more kind of biodynamic. What they're doing is they're spraying something that is a pheromone that's supposed to interrupt the mating cycle of the. In other words, they're trying not to use an invasive pesticide, and they're trying to get rid of this plant, which is creating a good breeding ground for the mosquito. And what strikes me about this whole thing with the mosquito is again that air travel has made the world so small. It's so tiny now because it can be a single mosquito that hitches a ride on a plane and ends up, you know, biting a bird, and then the bird carries it all over the world. So it's very frightening, but I always want to go back to the more practical solutions, which is to make sure that we aren't creating good breeding grounds for these insects.
That's right, and it's very interesting. Everywhere this disease seems to have spread, you find human activity has contributed to it. If human activity is in that, then certainly we can change our behavior. In the East, the mosquito that carried it most frequently, the northern house mosquito, bred very well in the bottom of flower pots, bird baths that were never changed, even gutters and around homes. It also bred very well in the city sewers, New York City.
Yeah, because they had no rain for a while.
And that's right. Paradoxically, the lack of rain drought helps this mosquito because it means that the pockets of water that do exist become very concentrated and rich in nutrients, which is what these mosquitoes like. And then you get these dry periods that are followed by heavy rains, and it kind of unleashes them all. And this is one of the kind of signatures of global climate change, of these vacillations, these extreme weather events. Now, when it moved out, you know, Colorado was recently struck very hard on this virus's inevitable march towards California and becoming endemic there. And it's apparently the mosquito that carries it there breeds very well in irrigation ditches, you know, for farmland. And so, once again, you see that although it's a different type of mosquito that frequently carries it there, it is human activity, in this case, agriculture. And it's each place it goes, it seems to follow in some sense what humans have done to the land. And once again, these are large issues that the disease is beginning to force us to take stock in. How we combat it with what sort of agents we use, whether we're going to spray this area with pesticides as they did very foolishly in New York City, which was really more of a political decision than anything else. It quelled people's fear, and I'm speaking of citizens. I was living and working in New York at the time, and that is what people in their panic demanded. And so this was nothing that was forced upon them, but it goes back to my plea for when these things emerge for people to just step back for a moment and look at the teachable lessons in here, and only then begin to chart out, okay, what can I do practically from protecting myself tonight to hoping to solve some of the problem within the next year.
So what are some suggestions that you would have given had they had you had really good input? I mean, if they had come to you and said, okay, Mark, tell us what to do, what would you have recommended?
Well, I think, once again, it's almost always on two levels. There's the short term, the near term, and the longer term. Certainly, the use of pesticides, if people demanded that they be used, they should have been done not aerial sprayed, but put in a much more focused area of where the larvae were, as opposed to where adults were flying around. The, New York City was saturated. That was totally unnecessary. Secondly, yes, you do want to stay inside at dusk or at in the evening and in the morning when the mosquitoes are most out, and you can use some sort of repellent. There are botanical lotions to use. Some
citronella
people,
and things like that.
Yes, who discard that, mostly not because they're not effective to some degree, but simply because they don't last as long as the more poisonous compounds.
Yeah, although you can burn citronella candles, too, if you have to be outside.
Yes, and so there are those things. But once again, a lot of these drastic solutions are made in a panic, and largely, or at least in some cases, driven by the public outcry and fear of new diseases. And I think the wiser people do step back and say, now wait, what are some of the more sensible things that, you know, that we
well,
can do?
You know what it reminds me of is I recently did a show with Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, and we were talking about the epidemic of metabolic syndrome or diabetes epidemic that's occurring in this country. And he was pointing back to the environment, both the physical environment in the sense that people can't walk where they need to go. They can't exercise while they're working, and whether or not they have easy access to healthy foods and things like that, but also the political and social environment. And it seems to me that in the end here, all of these plagues, you know, like West Nile and stuff, go back to the environment. And if you have the kind of human density that you have in New York, you have to look at the physical environment to make sure that you're not leaving yourself wide open for this kind of invasion. And what I mean by that is, again, Dr. Fawcett mentioned the cholera epidemic, and what really stopped the cholera epidemic, although there was the use of things like, there were people like Hahnemann who came in with homeopathic treatments and stuff, and there were antibiotics, and there were all these various things, but the thing that really stopped the cholera epidemic was when they cleaned up the source of water. They didn't even know what was causing it. They just knew that the people in these areas had filthy water, and they had sewage leaking into the thing. And what you just mentioned about New York was it was an opportunistic environment for this to happen, because we can't control the traveling of these insects into our environment now that we have air travel and birds migrating and various things like that. But we can make the environment safe so that, you know, if the sewers aren't running right, we can say, hey, look, you know what? This created a problem with the mosquitoes. So what have we learned? We have to do something about this. Is that?
Yes, and I so often, you know, find people throwing up their hands in helplessness, feeling, you know, as if they are victims of nature once again. And, you know, we are not. You know, we are victims of our own ingenuity in many cases. And if you look at some of the great public health advances, you know, throughout history, these were not tweaks in the system. These were enormous overhauls of the way we lived and did business, the way we built our cities.
Bingo.
Just sewers, for example. You know, our cities were fundamentally different a century ago. And we have managed, because we had a very rude awakening about our health, to completely reconfigure our thinking and our building of cities all across the world. If that can be done, then I think we are at the point where we can make similar public health advances to begin to slow this tide of new epidemics, whether it's how we design our neighborhoods, where we put them, and you know, many other details of our lives, as well as fundamental, you know, choices
yeah.
we make.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I need to reluctantly let you go so I can earn some money for this wonderful station. And I really want to thank you for your efforts on this front of educating people on their role in the environment and how much it helps on every human level to work with the environment. So thank you for the book.
Thank you very much, and I was delighted to speak with your listeners.
Okay, thanks so much.